Earlier this year, in the wake of demonstrations against systemic racism in the criminal justice system, Governor Roy Cooper created a state task force for racial equity in criminal justice to study the system and offer recommendations to address widespread and systemic racial inequities. Earlier this month, 2 weeks ago, in fact, on December 14th, the task force issued its report with what turned out to be 125 different recommendations across the entire criminal justice system. You can read the report and get the list of recommendations online at the State Justice Department website, which is ncdoj.gov. James Williams is former public defender, longtime advocate for racial equity and criminal justice. He's with the Chapel Hill Carborough NAACP, among many other organizations right now. And he joins us on the phone to discuss the task force and the report. James, thank you so much for being with us today.
Aaron, it's always a pleasure to be with you, so I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So give us a sense of your just overall response to the report and the recommendations. Obviously, we won't be able to hit all 125, but what were your first takeaways?
Well, Aaron, you're right that the report is, I don't know, probably 140, 150 pages long. There are a number of recommendations that cover anything from the court system itself, policing, and various permutations of that. And so, obviously, we won't be able to go into all the details related to that. And quite honestly, I want to spend some additional time studying it in more detail myself. But one thing I think that's important to note is that this task force was co-chaired by Justice Anita Earls of the North Carolina Supreme Court and North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein. And I think that's important to note, because when you have people of that caliber and that status as co-chairs, I think it is some indication of how serious the governor, the chief justice, and the attorney general took this issue. And then the other thing that I think is worth commenting on is that there were four working groups, and they each had chairs of those working groups. And those working groups and those committees met on numerous occasions over the 4 or 5 months prior to the release of the report. In addition, I think the task force itself met, 10 or more times. And so I mentioned that to say a lot of work and effort and time went into the development of this report. And the third thing that I'll mention is that given the diversity of members of those working groups. So you had people from law enforcement, you had judicial officials, you had prosecutors, you had formerly impacted people, you had policymakers, you had people from a broad spectrum that were members of the task force and the working groups. And the fact that they were able to come to consensus on as many recommendations that they have, I think, is worth noting also. And so when we look at some of the details, some of the things that I think are worth mentioning of recommendations include some of the recommendations related to policing and law enforcement. And it's worth noting those because the impetus for this task force was the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and the circumstances of their killings, and this whole issue of policing and lethality and killings, unnecessary killings of Black people, and the protests that emanated from those deaths. Both nationally, but also here in the state of North Carolina, including here in Chapel Hill. And so we knew that policing was going to be a critical issue in the work of the task force, and there were numerous recommendations related to policing, including issues like body cameras, body-worn cameras, recommendations that those videos may be made more easily accessible to the public, recommendations related to policing oversight commissions or whatever the appropriate title is, empowering them to get access to more information and to be able to make, you know, more recommendations so that they could be some legitimacy to the concept of oversight by the public. Recommendations related to the use of citations more frequently instead of arrests, for instance. Those are just a few of some of those recommendations. And, of course, recommendations related to deadly force, recommendations and use of deadly force, recommendations related to no-knock warrants and making sure that those are used only under the most extreme circumstances and after certain steps are gone through, including warrants and things of that nature. So those are some of the recommendations related to policing. There were numerous others, including training, including data, a collection and analysis. And so that's just one area in and of itself. And I chose to kind of lead with that because that's been an issue that's been getting, you know, fairly significant attention here in the Chapel Hill Carrboro area or in Orange County for, you know, some years now, but, you know, here most specifically also following the killings of Breonna and George Floyd and others. And so that's one area that the report covers.
Speaking with James Williams, what else from the report stood out to you?
Another, I think, that's important is related to juvenile justice and some of the changes and recommendations that we see there, including, you know, on issues of life without parole for juveniles and making sure that those types of sentences, if they are imposed, are rare, and that there are certain protocols that have to be met before such sentences are imposed. And even if a sentence of that type is imposed, that after a specified period of time, let's say, and I can't recall now whether it's 20 or 25 years, but after a specified period of time, there will be a look back. Some entity will look back at that sentence and see if there have been changes in the person's behavior, their performance while in custody, those types of things that might merit a review of that sentence and a release at some date short of their being, they're dying in prison. Another juvenile justice piece, and something that's had a lot of discussion here in our area, is related to SROs and the use of SROs in schools, and some guidance related to training of SROs. I think there's a recommendation that there be some study related to both the necessity and the effectiveness or not of SROs as it relates to school safety. And another recommendation, if I'm not mistaken, is that before a case that is generated by school resource officer is referred to the criminal justice system for some sort of action, you know, whether it's juvenile or the adult system. It's a case that emanates from the school by an SRO. The school official has to sign off on that. So it can't just be the SRO, him or herself, that moves that case into the criminal system. You may recall that, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, the data related to, you know, our court system here in Orange County and our juvenile justice system, the percentage of cases that were generated from our school system for juveniles, it was close to 75 or 80% of those cases came from the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just indefensible, untenable. And so a lot of effort went into myself and others getting the school officials to look at, and court officials, we tried to get them also to look at, you know, how could we reduce the number of children that were being criminalized based upon behavior in schools that could be dealt with administratively. And over time, we, you know, we've made some progress. I think the percentage now in Orange County and Chapel Carborough school system is probably around, 40% or so. So there's been some fairly significant reduction, but it's still too high. And so hopefully the recommendations from the task force will help in that regard. Another recommendation related to juvenile justice is to encourage and support the formation of school justice partnership agreements, which is something that was recommended by a task force or a commission that was established by former Chief Justice Martin a couple of years ago. But a number of districts have been slow in implementing those partnerships, including our own. It should have been done a year or so ago. I think there's some movement on that now also. So related to juvenile justice, those are some of the things that have been recommended. Another area that I think is worth talking about that is an issue that has been, you know, an important issue here locally is bail reform. And some of the recommendations would be or include legislation to provide that all class 1, 2, and 3 misdemeanor offenses, that there be no money bail involved in those type cases. And that another area for bail reform, I think, is recommendation for funding and support for pretrial release programs, things of that nature. Recommendations that magistrates more readily use some means, as opposed to warrants when people are charged with offenses that are not, you know, serious felony offenses, so that they will not be the use of summons as opposed to an arrest warrant in those type situations. So those are some of the bail reform recommendations, but sort of a related to that is an effort to get localities to reduce the number of cases that result in people being charged for minor offenses stemming from local ordinances. And that's, you know, I think Chapel Hill in particular has a fairly robust list of local ordinances that can result in people being ensnared in the criminal justice system. So the recommendation is that there be a statute passed that would require that all those ordinances have a sunset period so that they would be eliminated from the books. And then if jurisdictions felt they were important enough or significant enough, then they could seek to have some of those reinstated. So those are some of the things that I think relate to the bail reform piece. Of course, there are a number of other recommendations related to bail that time probably doesn't permit me to get into. Another area I think that is important, relates to both law enforcement, traffic enforcement, and policing, and that is to require that local officials revise their traffic enforcement protocols to require informed consent for any type of search. Right now, any type of consent search. In other words, in a lot of places right now, if an officer stops someone either in a traffic stop or somebody walking down the street and they want to conduct a search but they don't have probable cause, then they ask the person for consent. Well, studies have shown that quite often people feel obligated to say yes when an officer says, "Can I search you?" Especially if it's a uniformed officer, and they don't know that they have a constitutional right to say no. And the data and statistics show that these requests for consent search are disproportionately people of color, especially black people. I think some of the data that we have been aware of for some time shows that, for instance, black drivers are 2 times more likely to be stopped by the police, but they are also 2 times more likely to be searched by the police once stopped. And quite often these searches are so-called consent searches. And so if you want to deal with that disparity, you have to make sure people know that they have the right to say, "No, just let me go on about my business." And so this informed consent provision will allow that to happen. Another point related to, was not so much related to policing, but it's indirectly related to policing, and that is driver's license suspensions for financial reasons. Quite often, people get a traffic offense. Just something like an inspired sticker or whatever the case may be, they get assessed a fine or cost. If they're unable to pay that cost, then DMV gets notified, and it's like an automatic revocation or suspension of their license. And here again, it disproportionately impacts people of color, black people, Hispanic people, because it's also a poverty-related issue that really has nothing to do with criminal justice and public safety. And so there's one of the recommendations by the task force is to sort of get rid of this automatic suspension of people's driver's license when it is based upon poverty, or if it's not an automatic, if they don't totally eliminate that happening, then there be some provision that their license is restored after a period of 1 year. Another piece related to the justice system and poverty is this issue of, and a lot of it is related to poverty because we just talked about bail, and that's related to poverty, but cost and fines and fees. we know about the cascading impact of the imposition of these costs and fines and fees on poor people who are disproportionately Black people and other people of color, and how that impacts their ability to be productive citizens and to not end up back in jail or in prison. And so there are recommendations related to making sure, for instance, that before a judge imposes a cost or fee, that they make sure that the person who is before the court has the ability to pay whatever that amount of money is, and they go through a process to help determine that. So that's another important aspect, and that's something that, here again, that we've worked on, you know, the racial, our Bar Racial Justice Task Force has just, when I say our, I mean District 18, has gone through a process where we've come up with some recommendations for our criminal justice stakeholders related to court costs and fees. And I think what we've come up with is consistent with, if not better, than the recommendations of this task force. So I think we were moving in the right direction, maybe a little faster than some other jurisdictions on this particular issue. Another thing that I think I would be remiss if I did not mention is that one of the things that this task force, governor's task force, recommended is the reinstatement of the Racial Justice Act. And I think that is huge, because if there's one area, and there are many, but if there's one area where it is crystal clear, where if anyone looks at the data, they know that race plays a pernicious factor, it is in the both the seeking but also the imposition of the death penalty in North Carolina, but also in a number of other states. In North Carolina, in an effort to address that, the legislature some years ago passed the Racial Justice Act. And that act was, basically allowed, a defendant who was given the death penalty, if he or she could show that race was a factor in his or her receiving the death penalty, then they would have a hearing. If they showed that that was the case, then they would not be released from prison, but their death sentence would be changed to a sentence of life without parole. Unfortunately, several years ago, the legislature saw fit to undo the Racial Justice Act. Well, this task force has recommended that the Racial Justice Act be reinstated. So those are some of the key areas, and we're just sort of scratching the surface, but those, I think, are some of the critical areas where recommendations have been made. There's another that I'll mention, because here again, when we look at lengthy sentences, when we look at people serving, 15, 20, 30-year sentences, sometimes more, or life sentences, then those individuals are disproportionately Black and people of color. So if you're going to be talking about racial justice reform and you don't look at that issue, then you're not going to change a lot when you look at the prison population, for instance. And so one of the things that is recommended is some sort of look back provisions, so that if a person has been convicted of first degree murder or some other offense or combination of offenses where they have received either life sentences or sentence of 30, 40 years, whatever the case may be, that after a period, a designated period of time, and it would depend upon the length of the sentence, but, you know, after a period of 15 or 20 or 25 years, there be a look back by either a parole commission or some other entity to see if, given that person's current situation and condition, that public interest and public safety might actually be served by releasing that person. And I think that that is a significant recommendation, and one that I hope, you know, here, you know, it will have to be something that is done legislatively. It can't be just done. It can't be done at the local level. But hopefully the legislature will see fit to consider legislation of that type and move forward on it. So those are some areas. One other thing that I'll mention is that a number of these recommendations are things that can be done locally. And so one of the, you know, I think one of the challenges for us, you know, whether, and by us, I'm using that term kind of broadly, I mean, you know, certainly the Chappaquahepa Harbor NAACP, the Orange, Northern Orange NAACP, our local racial justice task force, and any other group or entity that is justice oriented, what we need to do, we need to study these recommendations, see which ones that we locally can do better or to begin doing that we're not currently doing, and start that conversation with our, whether it's county commissioners, whether it's the district attorney's office, whether it's our district and superior court judges or law enforcement. Let's get busy doing that work. Because, you know, while there's some good and progressive things happening here locally, there's a lot more that can be done. And I'm hoping that this report will give us a framework to begin doing some of those additional things that we should be doing.
Speaking with James Williams, and I'm interested that you mentioned juvenile justice first as being particularly important in all of this, because there's 34 recommendations just for the court system, let alone the rest of the criminal justice system. And as we mentioned up top, this was kind of inspired by the demonstration specifically surrounding the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. So I think people looking at this would not necessarily immediately think, oh, juvenile justice is where we should start. But that's where you started. And I think it's important to emphasize how important the juvenile justice system is on just criminal justice at large.
Yes. And I think we're beginning to get a better sense of that in the state of North Carolina. You know, it took us so long to raise the age. I mean, until like a year and a half, 2 years ago, if you were 16 years old and you were charged and convicted of a crime in the state of North Carolina, you were treated as an adult. And, you know, people elsewhere in the nation were saying, what in the world is wrong with North Carolina? And it took a lot of time, it took a lot of effort, it took a lot of dedication to move us beyond that state here in this state. But it was finally done. But the reason, you know, is that, I mean, so much data, so much, you know, scientific analysis and understanding of experts, you know, have shown us and taught us that children are children, and that, you know, they're not fully developed mentally and psychologically, and we don't need to treat them as if they are sort of mini adults, because they're not. And from a public safety standpoint, it makes so much sense, because what was happening was that we were depriving these kids of an opportunity to to grow up and to be able to thrive and succeed, you know, as they got older, because they had that stigma, they had that mark already, especially if they were convicted of a felony, but even in a number of instances, misdemeanors that would impact their ability to get jobs or keep a job, to find places to stay, to go to college. And so you are creating a situation where public safety was actually hampered because a person without hope, you know, and then at some point it doesn't really matter. If I can't survive out here, then I might as well take my chances. And so it's just so important how we treat kids, you know, within our systems. And I say systems because not just criminal justice system, but the civil system also, when it comes down to who gets, you know, separated from their parents and, you know, that sort of thing. So it's just, it is extremely important. And I'm glad that, you know, significant amount of time and effort went into considering the juvenile justice aspects of this also. And one other thing that I did not mention as it relates to policing, because you reminded me when you said that, you know, sort of what precipitated this, the formation of this task force. Because one, let me just mention this, Eric. You know, 10 years ago, you know, it was because of an awareness that the state of North Carolina needed an entity to address these issues that the North Carolina Advocates for Justice formed a task force to look at race and criminal justice in North Carolina that led to the creation of the North Carolina Commission on Racial and Ethnic Disparities, which I now chair, because there was not a body in the state of North Carolina that was looking at the issue of race and criminal and juvenile justice and trying to come up with some ways to address those issues. Now, back then, there was much more denial about the issue than there is now. I mean, there still is some now, but I think there's certainly more acceptance that, number one, race is an issue within our criminal justice system, and number two, there are things that we can do about it. You know, I was glad to see this task force created, but the other thing that I'll mention is one of the things that led to, that helped prompt the need for this was not just the protests, but how protests were policed. And here again, the fact that a number of police departments were unnecessarily using force, sometimes deadly force, but quite often, and techniques that were totally inconsistent with people's right to protest and exercise their First Amendment rights within this country and this state and these counties. You see what happened, in Alamance County a few weeks ago, or maybe a month or two ago. But it wasn't just Alamance. There were a number of other places, you know, within the state of North Carolina where policing of protests were inappropriate. And so one of the other recommendations by this task force as it relates to policing is training on proper techniques related to policing and protests that will allow protesters to exercise their constitutionally protected rights without being unduly hampered or endangered by the police, but at least still be able to maintain some semblance of order and not to allow things to get out of hand. One of the things that was apparent, you know, across the nation, that quite often it was the response of the police and how the police responded that led to things getting out of hand. And so there's work to be done in that area also.
Speaking with James Williams, and you mentioned a lot of reforms relating to policing. One thing that really struck me about this particular report from this task force is the emphasis on the positive role of community policing as an approach to policing in general, and that's certainly something that we see locally. There have been a lot of really strong arguments against community policing in the context of this discussion this year. And the upshot is, if you've got a community policing system that encourages as much interaction between law enforcement and residents as possible in the context of systemic racism, where any interaction has the potential to go wrong, and that hits certain groups of people harder than others within a given population, then community policing might exacerbate the problem rather than make it better. This particular report really emphasizes community policing as a positive thing, and I was wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Well, you know, community policing is one of those things that definitions vary from organization to organization and from even police chief to police chief. But, you know, for me, and I think the concept of community policing is a concept that policing is done in conjunction with the community. In other words, the community itself helps define and delineate how policing takes place within those communities, as opposed to the police having a meeting on occasion, or let's say we're going to make sure we have an officer in this particular community, or we're going to sit down and have coffee with a cop, you know, every month, you know, at some location and invite people from that community. No, that is not community policing. And so, you know, community policing is something where the community is much more engaged and involved in what policing looks like within that community. So it takes work, I think, both by people within the community and by the department. But it's important that the department have that mindset that we're not just going to come in and tell you guys what we're going to do, and, you know, you're to accept that. It's got to be sort of more of a quid pro quo, so to speak, you know, at least in my opinion. And I think with that type of concept that I believe this task force was talking about as it relates to community policing. Because, you know, if it's the other concept where, you know, we just want to give it a veneer, and the community itself actually has no power, no authority, no, you know, autonomy to kind of impact what policing looks and feels like, then that's not community policing, in my opinion.
Speaking with James Williams, we got to wrap up. Any other thoughts about the report or next steps?
Well, you know, I think your point about next, you know, so report is just that. It's just a report. And it's got some wonderful ideas and recommendations that have the potential of sort of reimagining public safety, for instance. But in order for it to really make a difference, there has to be the hard work put into making these recommendations, or as many of them as possible, reality. And that's going to require working with legislators. It's going to require working with administrative bodies. It's going to require working with various law enforcement organizations and you know, local politicians and community groups to get buy-in. Because you can't change a law in the state of North Carolina unless you get the legislature to do it. So I think a lot of work and effort is going to go into to that over the next year or two. The other thing that I'll mention is this. One of the things that's recommended is within the next 2 years, creating a permanent commission on race and criminal justice in the state of North Carolina. I think that would be significant if it is done and if it is properly funded and if it is given the latitude to do the work, in a significant way, other than making, you know, surface recommendations and things of that nature. So that's something I think to be noted. And also, there is somewhere a recommendation of a truth and reconciliation type commission on race and criminal justice, the history of race and criminal justice in the state of North Carolina, because quite often, you know, it's important to understand that history to get a grasp as to how things got to be as they are, in order to appreciate the magnitude of the effort that might be required to change them. And so I think those are some things that I'm looking forward to, in the next, several months to a year as it relates to the work of this task force.
Again, you can get the full report online at ncdoj.gov. That's the Department of Justice website for the state, ncdoj.gov. Get the full report, all 125 recommendations and more. James Williams, thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.